I'm quite excited about this podcast because this is my first podcast with someone from down under in Australia. So I'm in Scotland and Lee is just outside of Sydney in Australia. Lee, why don't you introduce yourself?
All right, so my name's Lee, and I guess I started being interested in this area of dyslexia about 7 years ago. I've got a 12-year-old son who, when he was in preschool, everything was going along fine. All his preschool teachers said, nothing to worry about, all good, send him off to kindergarten. Off he went to kindergarten, and within about a term and a half, so 15 or so weeks, he was coming home and saying, it's hard for me, I'm not learning my sounds, why is it harder for me than it is for everybody else? And so I had a background in primary teaching. I'd been a primary school teacher for about 12 years by this point. And so, I started thinking, okay, if it's hard for him to learn his sounds, then we've got to sort of get to the bottom of this. Lots of visits in and out of school and, had comments like, he's fine, there's nothing wrong, he'll get by on his smile, all of these sorts of things that as a parent and as a teacher, you go, this is not right. So we plodded along for about another 12 months. And I guess for me, a mistake that I made was treading too carefully. I went in there with my parent hat on instead of my teacher hat on and listened too much to what they had to say and backed down on things that I knew that I probably should have stood up for. But I was very aware of not being that parent who was that bossy teacher that is telling us how to do our job. And in hindsight, I should have stood my ground, but I didn't. So we went along for, another 12 months or so, saw a developmental paediatrician, had assessments done, and got a provisional diagnosis of specific learning difficulty, which is what they call dyslexia over here. They don't use dyslexia in their diagnostic manuals anymore. It's called specific learning difficulty, as well as inattentive type ADD. So for me, it then became about realizing that school was not going to help this child. They were using a program in school called Reading Recovery, which has been proven in recent years to be a failure. Kids are not learning to read using this program. It's a whole language approach. So I went about finding out what else can I do so that I don't fail this child. I found a lady in Newcastle, so that's about 2 hours north of where we live, who was using a particular reading program that was phonics based. I went and listened to her speak a couple of times on working memory and learning difficulties and listened about her program. And I thought, this is it. This is the thing that's going to work. The difficulty being that her clinic was in Newcastle, 2 hours away, and we were in Sydney. So we started doing a remote version of her program where we would do it over the phone once a week. The course materials would be sent to me. I would sit alongside him while he worked with, a young teacher or a uni student over the phone, and we could see progress straight away. I went and met with this lady who had written this program through a university and said, "You need to get this out. You need to bring this to Sydney." And she didn't know how to go about that. She had a hands full with her practice in Newcastle. So a little idea, I guess, started to form in my mind, and I brought that program down to Sydney. So I found a room that I could use in a local medical practice, set up there, seeing, first 2 kids a week and then 3 kids a week. And it's since grown from there, and I now see about 60 to 70 kids a week with 3 other teachers working with me there.
Wow. So are you dyslexic?
So no, I'm not dyslexic. My son is. I suspect that my husband probably very mildly is, and I suspect my father and my husband's father most likely both are as well.
Okay. So what I like to do in these podcasts is follow a story arc, as it were. The 4 questions that I'm going to ask you are: where did it all begin? What woke you up in that dyslexia story? What person or event? And then what was the main challenge, and how did you go through that challenge? How did you overcome? Maybe you haven't yet. And then what rewards are you getting, or what rewards are you hoping to get? We'll just follow that kind of pattern. Where would you say it all began?
I would say it certainly began when my son was in that, first and second year of school, thinking school is not going to be able to solve this or help with this enough. I need to go and source a way to figure this out and to help my child.
So that was the beginning. What kind of woke you up?
I think
was it a person, an experience?
So it was going and sitting in on a couple of lectures with a lady called Amanda from Newcastle, who spoke about working memory and kids with learning difficulties and this reading program that she had started that was called Rip It Up Reading. And she was a very passionate speaker. And I knew sitting and listening to her the first time that her way of teaching reading was going to be the way that worked for my child. So
how long was it between before? So let's do it in ages rather than years. I find years okay. quite hard. So how old was he when you started to wonder?
So when we started to wonder, he would have been 5.5.
Okay. And then when you went to hear this talk?
He would have been 7.
7, 2 years, yep. A year and a half of being the nice mum.
Yes. Yes, trying not to tread on too many toes.
Yes.
And I don't do that anymore.
You don't. You've learned your lesson, have you?
Now I tread on toes.
You became Mama Bear.
I did. And I had to, and I wish I'd done it sooner.
Yes. And 2-hour drive up to hear this talk. And did you go on your own?
I did. I did go on my own. And then when I decided this is the path we're going to go down, I took my son with me to see her. So we did the 2-hour drive and he met with her and had a full assessment done and decided, you know, yes, we're going to give this program a go. The logistics then were we couldn't drive every week 2 hours to go and have this done. So how is it going to happen? And we started doing it remotely. So that was where the weekly phone calls started. And I remember when I got the resources in the first place, I was excited and I thought, you know, this is going to be, you know, groundbreaking and it's going to be amazing. And I've been teaching for 12 years and it'll be like nothing I've ever seen. And then I got it and I was kind of a bit deflated. I went, is this it? Like, it's really not rocket science. And that's the frustrating thing, is teaching kids to read shouldn't be rocket science and it shouldn't be a secret and every school should do it. And they don't. And I don't understand why, because it's not hard. We know the information, the research is there. Why are we not doing it everywhere?
Yes. So many of the parents who are listening will be, well, they might have children your age. How old is he now? How old is your son now?
He's 12 now, and he's in his 12. First year at high school.
So he's now moved to high school. Okay. Mm. And so, would you say that your challenge is over now?
I don't think so. I think my challenge is constantly changing as he grows. And I think, you know, initially the challenge was, you know, get him reading. And then it was settling down the anxiety that came from not being able to do things as well as everybody else. And it's a different challenge all the time. So then we had the challenge of moving him from the local public school where he was to do his last 2 years of primary school at a private school. Okay. Because I had sourced a learning support teacher that I knew what she was doing. And so okay. It wouldn't have mattered whether that was a public school, an independent school. Wherever I found the right learning support teacher was where I was going to move him to. So we did that, and he was in year 5, so he would have been 10 when we did that. About the same time, we sourced a private, what we call in Australia, MSL tutor, which I think you guys would call OG or Orton Gillingham.
Yes.
So, and he's been working with her ever since. And she, I guess, was my next point of inspiration, where I saw what she was doing with these kids one-on-one and thought, there's more to what I'm doing than just delivering this reading program. You know, what about spelling? What about fluency? What about comprehension? What about all of the other bits and pieces? So I sort of took a leaf out of her book, I guess, and went and did further study in Orton Gillingham or MSL, the Australian adaptation of that. And now I use that with my son, but also with all those other kids that come to the practice. So in terms of the challenge was, you know, getting a 5 and a 6-year-old to read. The challenge is now getting that you know, child who was 5 or 6, who's now 12, getting him through high school, educating high schools somewhat in how to make adjustments to assessments, to assignments, to classwork. And the challenge at high school is, you know, they don't just have one teacher all the time. They've got a different teacher every hour, and that can change every term. And so as a parent, it's very much making yourself known and treading on those toes in the nicest possible way, because we've got to, you know, work with these teachers. And I'm really lucky where he is, that his teachers are really happy to work with me. They're not, you know, it's our way and we know best. They're very, very open to discussion about how can we improve things. And I've been really happy with that. I guess on a wider scale, my challenge is, well, my kid's just one kid. I really want these changes to be put into effect for, you know, the kid next door and the kid down the street and the kid in the next suburb. So I've set myself a bit of a challenge within my practice to help as many kids. But for me, it's almost as much about the mums, because I've been that mum that had a 5-year-old and didn't know what to do. And now I see mums come in every week who've got a 5-year-old who doesn't know their sounds, or a 10-year-old who's not reading, or sometimes a 14-year-old who comes in and they're not reading. And the challenge for me becomes really personal, because I used to be that mum with that kid. So
yeah,
it's how can I settle that anxiety, you know, tell them that it's not panic stations, but we have a method and a system, and it might be really slow or it might happen really quickly, and we just have to plot our way through. But we get them reading, and then it becomes about, all right, they're reading, but what else do they need to do to be able to get through high school? And so for me, it's always about getting the kids through happy and whole. They don't have to, you know, get A's, or, you know, they just have to get through happy and whole. And that's the challenge now for my kid, but also for all those kids that I see.
I have a similar kind of story where my daughter crashed and burned when she was 14. She had these amazing primary school teachers. It was a private little primary school. The teachers were so clued up about dyslexia. They realized she had a challenge, and they just worked with her systematically, phonically. And as a result, you know, she got into high school, a grade A student. And then it was only when she hit the exams that we realized, my goodness, she's crashing. And the teachers were saying to her things like, we think you're being lazy. And we were like, we know she's not being lazy. And we started to hear these rumblings. You know, she started to quote her teachers saying this, that, and the next thing. And we're like, that's odd. And then 6 months later, she crashes in her exams and she's starting to get B's, C's, and D's, and some A's. And we're like, this is strange from a grade A student. And then she said, Dad, teach me how to study. And she just didn't know how to study. And her challenge wasn't reading and writing. It was just organizing her head, her thoughts, her time, her essays. Gosh, her essays. You know, thankfully, my wife is the one who's much more literate than me and restructures essay after essay after essay. But that's the big challenge for her. So the reward. So you're not through the big challenge yet. It's not like you're, you know, 10 years into it or 15 years through it and your child's grown up and, you know, on their feet and is some sort of entrepreneur or artist or architect or some of the typical things that dyslexics become. You don't have that kind of story. You're right in the midst of it.
We are. So we've gotten through primary school and we're happy and we're whole, but we've still got, you know, between 4 and 6 years to go on the high school challenge. And new things pop up with that every day, you know, the assignments and the assessments and the, you know, like you just said, we just had his first round of half yearly exams and he's been told, well, go home and study. You don't just know how to study. Someone has to explicitly teach you how to do it. And that doesn't happen. And some kids are really lucky in that they've got parents at home who can sit down and teach them how to study. But not all kids have that. Either parents, you know, aren't home or are working or don't have those skills themselves. And so, you know, my kids got two parents who know how to teach that, but so many kids don't. And so they're the kids that you worry about. I guess personally, I used to worry what would become of my child when he finished school. You know, how, let's say we get him through Happy and Whole, what's he going to do? What's he going to be? And I honestly don't worry about that anymore. Like, I 100% know that he will find his place and he's going to be fine, because he's got all of those awesome dyslexic traits that are going to help him survive. Like, he's creative, he's quick, he's bright. So that challenge of what's he going to do or be, I don't even worry about that. I don't see that as a challenge. It's getting him to the point where he can start to do that. And schools cater for one type of child. And, you know, one in five kids are not that type of child. So for that one in five, we've just got to get them to the other end so that then they can get out and thrive. So is the challenge over? No, it just evolves. It just changes, you know, from term to term or year to year.
Yeah. So normally I ask, what's the reward you've got so far from the challenge? And maybe you've not got the reward yet, or maybe you're seeing some of the rewards. Can you say something about that?
I do. So with him, I see, with my own child, I see rewards in little ways. So when I see him sit and pick up a book that he wouldn't have been able to read a few years ago, or listen to an audio book and hear him laugh out loud, those kinds of things are my rewards. Or when I go to a meeting with a teacher or get an email that talks about not his ability, but that talks about, you know, his effort and his attitude, and that even though everyone knows it's really hard for him, he always tries everything and he doesn't give up. So that's the reward for me, is to know that I've got a resilient child who, even though it's been really hard and there's been tears and it's been frustrating, everybody knows him as the kid who keeps trying. So that's a reward. Professionally, the reward is talking to the parents of the kids that I work with and seeing how relieved they are that they know that there's a way through for their kids. For example, yesterday I had a session with a boy who's now in year five that I've been working with for about 4 years, and he is profoundly, profoundly dyslexic. And despite 4 years of really quality phonics-based intervention, he's still struggling with, you know, CVC three-letter words. So yesterday we introduced him to a C-pen, which I'm not sure if you've got the same or an equivalent over there, but it's like a little pen that you scan over your text and it reads the text out loud to you as it's scanning, and also to the Vision Australia audiobook library, which is an audiobook library for people with a vision impairment, but with a diagnosis of dyslexia, we can also get them free access to that. So for him, this has just opened up a whole library full of books that can be read to him. So I said to him yesterday, you know, what are your mates reading that you really want to read, but you just know it's going to be too hard? And he said, Skullduggery Pleasant. So we looked it up and he listened to the first few pages and his eyes lit up. And then we went out to the waiting room and he showed his mum, and he showed his mum what he can do with the C-pen, and she just was in tears. So for me, that's the reward. Is that,
yes,
that kid's just had a whole world opened up to him, despite the fact that even though he's worked his little butt off, he still can't read well. He is still going to be able to listen to and comprehend and talk about all those books.
They call it reading with your ears.
Yes, we call it ear reading. And part of the challenge, I guess, another challenge, is to convince the kids that are using, you know, dictation and C-pens and audiobooks, is that it's not cheating. We have to get away from that mindset that using this tech is cheating. It's not cheating. It's using a tool. And I'm really passionate about giving these kids every possible tool. And I use the example with them of, you go to a doctor or a medical specialist, and at the end of your appointment, they pull out their little recorder and they dictate a note to their secretary, who will then, you know, type up their note for them, or they dictate and straight away it appears in text on their screen. Now, they're not doing it because they're dyslexic or, you know, because they need the help. They're doing it because it's a smart way to do it. So I'm trying to teach all of these kids that it's not cheating, and educate their families and their schools that it's not cheating any more than me wearing my glasses is, or, you know, someone using a wheelchair who needs it. It's their tool and it's a smart way to do it. So why wouldn't we?
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose it's kind of like deciding to pick up the telephone rather than walking 20 miles to go and tell someone something.
That's right.
I was interested by you. You're in an interesting situation because you're a parent of a dyslexic who knows things that your child needs to learn. And I was in a similar situation, trying to teach my child how to mind map. And it's not as easy as you think, because it brings in some extra dynamics mm-hmm. where it's not like you're the professional coming in, you're mum or whatever. Tell us a little bit about what it's like for you in that sort of setting.
Yeah, look, it is interesting. I'm fortunate, as I said, that I've got a kid who will give anything a go, and he knows no different, really. He's always been used to, come on, let's sit at the table and let's do something. It's always been that way, because I knew that his learning to read and learning to spell was on my shoulders. So we've always kind of sat together and done that. But I really think it's healthy for him to do it with other people other than me. So he's had this fabulous teacher, Victoria, once a week or once a fortnight for about the last 3 years. And the watching the difference in him when he sits down with me straight away, because I'm mum, you know, we're tense and we're, you know, the shoulders are up and you can see this panic, like, I can't do it. And I can't figure out if that's, I don't want to disappoint mum and not be able to do it, or if it's just, it's only mum so I can be myself and this is how anxious I always feel, but I can show her. When he sits down to do it with somebody else, so learning support teacher at school or Victoria, his private tutor, he has none of that. Mm. So there's no anxiety shown. I'm sure it's probably in there. I think it's really important to being the mum and being the teacher is to outsource that teaching of your own child. And I think that's really good for them, but I think it's good for a relationship as a mother and child as well, because you don't want your relationship to be all about learning and the hard stuff. So if you're fortunate enough that you surround yourself with a village of other passionate advocates like I've done, you can call on them to help with your child and just say, you know what, you take over that role for a little while. So, yeah, finding a group of people who understand your journey but also who are skilled enough to do for your child what you want to do yourself but shouldn't, if that makes sense.
It does. So basically what you're saying is that I think I'm hearing is that Victoria is doing stuff with your son that you could be doing.
That's not right. Like
she's got special skills you don't have.
No, look, and initially she did. I learned a lot from her and she was one of my big inspirations. And there's still things that she knows far more about than I do. We've both got, you know, different strengths and areas. Like I'm really passionate about the assistive technology and she's like the grammar and, you know, morphology queen. So he gets different things from her, but relationship-wise, I think it's far healthier for him to work with somebody else.
Okay, great. So let's move on to the next segment where we talk about dyslexia in particular. Obviously, we've talked a lot about dyslexia so far, it's a dyslexia podcast. But let's talk about dyslexia and learning in a more general sense. So I often ask people, where can you see the influence of dyslexia through this whole story? And you've kind of made that quite clear. But maybe looking back, there's maybe a few things you can see traces of dyslexia and maybe in unexpected ways. Because I think sometimes when you look back on things, you can see the effects of dyslexia more than in the reading and the writing. Yes, it's definitely in the reading and writing, but you can see it in other areas.
Yeah, for sure. So I see it in things like organisational skills, just, you know, general bedroom chaos and, you know, oh, we're on our way to school, but I need my musical instrument and I forgot it, and I need my hat today and I forgot it. And it becomes, I think, the older they get, about being able to not only self-regulate, but also they've got to find the skills and strategies for managing their time and for managing their stuff. So for us, time has been about, you know, having an organizer or a calendar of what happens each day of the week and which day do I need my instrument and which day do I need canteen money and which day do I need a sports uniform to get changed into and all that kind of thing. And then in terms of managing belongings and stuff, it's, you know, it's labeling, it's visual timetables, it's just kind of having a constant discussion about, you know, what day is it today? What do we need today? Don't leave this on the bus. If you leave this in your locker, you know, we can't go back and get it. I think we've been through about four different locks for his locker this year because he forgets his key and has to get the bolt cutters and cut it off and, you know, all that kind of thing. But we expect it to happen. So, yes. And there's no point, you know, being cross or cranky about these things because in the scheme of things, it's a lock on a locker or it's a hat left on a bus. Like, they're little things. And I think these kids have so much to deal with every day and their head is just full and it's so full that stuff falls out of it. And so if the stuff that falls out of it is my locker key or my hat, then I'd rather that be the stuff that falls out of it than, you know, safety and, you know, manners and compassion and all those things. So if we lose the odd locker key or the odd hat, it's a small thing.
Great. That's great perspective. So learning moments. This is a segment that I like to include because I'm really fascinated about how people learn and all the different ways they learn. Maybe this is you. Okay, this may not be a dyslexic moment because you're not dyslexic, but how do you learn? What have been the profound learning moments you've seen in this journey? Has it been formal learning? Has it been people, podcasts? What sort of things have been moments for you?
For me, I think it's two things. It's about the people that I seek out in terms of surrounding myself with people who are experts in this field. So I live and breathe dyslexia and advocacy and assistive technology and getting these kids through school. So I surround myself with people like that. So other specialist teachers, other advocates, and it's about that conversation and that discussion and that being able to call on each other, hey, I need something for this, or what's the best way to teach that? So, you know, and I do that through a few different Facebook groups that I'm on and some professional memberships, things like that. And it's also about, I learn a lot from the families that I work with. So it's about a family presenting me with a challenge. You know, we've got this assignment, we don't know how to tackle it, or we just can't work together because we fight all the time, or we've come to the realization that this reading thing is not going to happen for my kid. How are we going to get them access? How are we going to get them access to books, to words, to text? So in someone presenting me with a problem and me going chasing the solution, that's how I learn, and I'm really motivated to do that because I want to solve that problem for that family or that kid or that mum.
Okay. So basically what I'm hearing is you're a relational and hands-on type learner, and those are the experiences that really drive you.
Yeah, they are.
The next segment is mind mapping experience. What's been your experience of mind mapping? Obviously, I'm passionate about mind mapping, running Mind Map Studio, and I'm fascinated by people's personal experiences with mind mapping. What's your experience of mind mapping been?
So you'll probably be disappointed. not a lot. I've used it not in the way you use it. So when I was classroom teaching and I was teaching in a library for several years, we used to use Inspiration and Kidspiration, those mind mapping type programs, but it was more about giving kids experience with, you know, computers and manipulating shapes and all that kind of thing. It wasn't, you know, putting your ideas down into a map. It was, you know, you might be researching a person or a country and there wasn't necessarily a good structure. So to learn about it from you in recent weeks has been really eye-opening in terms of I'm seeing it as a real, I guess, answer to one of those problems that keep getting posed to me by families. How do we teach them to study? How do we plan a paragraph? How do we get them to structure something? So I've gone hunting for, all right, how can I solve this problem for these high school families that I've now got? How can I structure an essay, a paragraph, study notes. And so for me, this is becoming one of the answers at the moment. So it's not something I know a lot about, but it's something that I want to keep learning about to try and solve the problem.
Oh, that's fascinating. So your main experience of mind mapping has been Inspiration, the computer program, and that's pretty much it?
And just at a very basic level.
Okay, right. Were you ever taught it as a primary school teacher?
No, we weren't. I wasn't taught most of the things that you need to know for in a classroom. You know, mind mapping wasn't taught. Teaching kids how to read wasn't taught. You know, it's a real downfall in the education system. Graduates coming out of uni now, I've had a couple of prac students in my clinic, and they're coming to me on their final prac and saying, I've been at uni for 3 years and no one's ever taught me how to teach a kid how to read.
Wow.
And next year, these students coming out of uni are going to be on kindergarten classes teaching kids how to read, and they don't know how to do it yet.
What are they being taught?
They're being taught educational theory. So, you know, the old Vygotsky and Pavlov and all those things are still happening. They're being taught minimal behavior management. They might attend one lecture on kids with special needs. I don't understand why fundamental things like how to teach kids how to read, what is phonics, what's phonological awareness, what's phonemic awareness, they don't know. It's not being taught. So if those things are not being taught, then something like, you know, mind mapping and study skills and is certainly not being taught.
Yes. How did you come across? Because I'm going to talk about the difference between Australia and the UK with dyslexia. We need to have a little extra segment about that, okay?
Yes.
But before we go on to that, how did you find out about the mind mapping?
So one of your Facebook ads, I guess it probably was, popped up on my Facebook feed and was just a link that I followed and went, okay, this, you know, this will be interesting, shared with a few of my teachers, and they were, you know, both very into it as well. So one of my girls is a high school trained teacher, and she's done the last 10 years or so teaching high school English, geography and history. So she was particularly interested. And another one of my girls has four children, and a couple of those have real issues with their expressive language and their expressive writing. So she was interested, again, from two points of view, with the mum hat on, but with the teacher hat on for the kids that she helps. So over the last couple of weeks, you know, we've all done your intro class and then, you know, another one, and hoping to try and use that with some of the kids that we work with for their, you know, expressive writing and writing structure and things like that.
What did you think about the bullet map that we did this morning?
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, helpful.
So let's move on. Let's talk about the next segment, which is what advice would you give? What advice would you give your teenage self if you were dyslexic? So let's say you had to say something to a dyslexic teenager. What would you say to them?
I would say, be the kid who doesn't quit. Be the kid who tries and has that great attitude, even though you might not want to be, because those are the kids that the teachers are not going to give up on. Don't be the kid that goes in with the attitude of, I'm never going to do this, or why are you trying to teach me sounds, because that's for babies and I'm 15 now. The kids that I've seen that do really well are the kids that come in going, even though I'm 15 and I can't read, let's do the sounds, even though kindy kids do them. So I would say trust the adults that know what they're talking about and go with it, because that's your quickest path to success.
That's funny you say that, because I was at a barbecue with the daughter of one of my friends, and she was saying, how do you spell Olympic? Because she wanted to type in Olympic sailing boat. And I went, O-L-Y-M-P-E-C-U-R-L-Y-C. And she was like, you know, why are you using baby words? I'm a grown up, and I'm not a baby. And I said, well, I'm dyslexic. That's how I think about words. And she was like, oh, really? You know? And there was something in that moment where it was like, I'm 47 years old. I'm happy to use phonic sounds because they're very accurate. And it was quite interesting. And in that moment, she was like, okay, it's all right to use them.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. And you know what? I think sometimes kids need to know it's all right to do these things. Like, they need to know it's all right to use their sounds. They need to know it's all right to use their assistive tech or whip out their phone and take a photo of the notes instead of sit there and painstakingly handwrite them. They need to know it's all right to ear read instead of read with their eyes. And we need to make it all right. And I think that we need to model that, and teachers need to model that and take away the stigma of, you know, it's cheating or it's babyish or, you know, whatever else is placed on it. I think we need to make it acceptable and make it the new normal.
Well, that's a good segue to what advice would you give parents, a parent of a teenager?
So I would say,
I'll tell you what, actually, what advice would you give yourself? Okay.
Right.
Say you had to remind yourself of this in a year's time or something. What advice would you give yourself? Yeah.
I would say never go back to being the mum who was afraid to tread on toes. Mm. Keep treading on toes, but do it with a smile so that people are willing to work with you instead of feel like you're working against them. So, you know, don't go into a meeting or a school, you know, you've done this wrong, I want you to do it this way. Go into a school saying, how can we change things so that it benefits, you know, the one in five. And for me, it's not just about my child anymore. It's about all the kids who need it. And it's 20% of kids, you know, it's six kids in every class of 30. So they all deserve it, not just mine. So it's reminding myself that it's about all of the kids, but to always fight and not go, oh no, I'm not going to suggest that, or I'm not going to say that because I might offend someone, or say it, tread on toes, get things done.
Brilliant. Thank you. So before we move on to dyslexia tools, I think it would be really interesting to talk a bit about the difference between Australia and the UK when it comes to dyslexia. Now, my sister's in Australia. She has a dyslexic child, and she knows the UK well, and she knows Australia well, and she knows there's a very big difference between the way
she must be very frustrated
in the UK and in Australia. And I think some of our listeners will be Australian and some of them will be UK and America, all around the world. I've got people from Buenos Aires and India and South America and Africa that are my students and parents and will probably be listeners as well. But let's just concentrate on Australia and the UK. What do you know about the way Australia treats dyslexia and the UK?
So over here, it's often a case of you have to fight for it to be recognised. So it's not uncommon for a parent to take a report into a school from an educational psychologist that says, you know, this child has a specific learning difficulty, you know, in writing or in spelling or in reading, so dyslexia or dysgraphia, and school will say, well, that doesn't exist, or is dyslexia even a thing? So there's not a lot of education about it. Principals, executive staff sometimes will deny that it exists.
I know that there are the odd person or two, teacher or two in the UK who would say, I'm not sure about this dyslexia thing. It might just be a bit of an excuse for overbearing mothers and so forth, and kids who are trying to make excuses. I know there's a few odd teachers who are thinking that, and they're very much the exception rather than the norm, you know. Are you saying that that's quite common?
It is. It's quite common. The other thing that's quite common is that the teachers or exec or principals who do, you know, think it's, you know, a real thing, have a real misconception about what it is. So often I'll chat to a teacher about dyslexia and I say, oh yeah, that's reading things backwards, or that's letters moving around on the page. And so we know that dyslexia is not a visual issue, but their misconception is that it's letters moving on a page or it's reading words backwards. So there's so much more to it, and everybody can present differently.
I thought I didn't have dyslexia until I was 35 because the letters didn't move on the paper for me. They stayed still. And I thought, well, I'm obviously not dyslexic because the letters don't move for me. And then I get my test when I'm 35 and the assessor says, here's the numbers. There's your IQ. There's your ability compared to your IQ for this. There's this, there's that. There's a real anomaly here. This is probative. You know, it's a statistical variation that's significant and you're dyslexic. And I was like, oh my goodness, I couldn't believe it. And the other interesting thing was, I've just been working with an educational psychologist here, a doctor, and we went through a test. I'm creating this sort of dyslexia test of different indicators. One of the purposes behind the test is that at the end of the test, it's only the final sort of 5 or 10 questions out of 100 that are relevant to reading and writing. All the rest are indicators that show dyslexia in other aspects of your life. And I got her to rank them, to weight the indicators on a scale of 0 to 10, so that when people said yes, no, or strong or medium on a scale of 1 to 10, they would then be multiplied by this multiplier and they would get a rough idea, a more accurate idea than saying I've got 70 out of 100 indicators. Mm-hmm. And two of the questions were letters jump around on the page. And she said, give that a 5 or a 6, 7 max, because that's not often that common in dyslexics. And it's just fascinating going through these indicators and the ones that people attribute to be mostly indicative of dyslexia are actually in real life low indicators of dyslexia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Crazy.
It is. So I think there must be a difference in the way that our teachers are educated to the way that they're educated in the UK. If your teachers are coming out of uni or college and knowing what it is, what to look for and what to do about it,
I think they're not. I mean, the reality in the UK is that in Scotland, teachers get, in the 1 year teaching program, so you do your degree and then you get 1 year of teaching, or you do 3 years of learning to be a teacher. In either of them, you get 3 hours of teaching in the curriculum on disabilities.
Right.
And one of those hours will be related to helping them understand something about dyslexia and dysgraphia and dyscalculia. And that will be it. 1 hour if you went to the lecture.
It seems like such a small percentage of their time to be spent on learning about students who make up such a large percentage of the population in classrooms.
Yes. I mean, and the challenge that they are going to present to them as teachers, if it's not actually addressed, is massive.
Mm.
I mean, I just heard, I spoke to a primary school teacher who was involved in dyslexia help and so on. She burnt out after 5 years as a primary school teacher. And I said, you know, I kind of burnt out as a primary school teacher after 5 years as well. I was a rural standard school teacher. And she said the average time is 3.5 years to burn out as a primary school teacher in the UK right now. 3.5 years. Couldn't believe it.
Yep.
And if teachers are burning out at that kind of rate, the pressure's on them, you know, and then you go up to them and you say, I'd like you to learn about dyslexia because my son's got it and so on. And you need to understand this, that, and the next thing. You know, they must be thinking, you know, the straw that breaks the camel's back, or add it to the list.
That's right. And, you know, I absolutely, and the advocates in Australia, we absolutely don't blame the teachers. It's the classroom teachers that are caught in the middle, I guess. They're not taught how to identify and what to do about it, yet we're giving them a classroom with 5 or 6 kids with additional learning needs and saying, just figure it out as you go. And then they're dealing with the parents who are disappointed because their kids are not learning, and they're dealing with the kids who are, you know, becoming emotionally, you know, upset or having anxiety. They're dealing with kids who are not succeeding because they've got additional learning needs that aren't being dealt with. But how can you deal with those learning needs if no one's ever taught you how? And in reality, a lot of these kids are coming out of uni and being put into classrooms to teach, and they might be 20, 21, 22 years old, and they've got 6 or 7 kids in front of them who might have ADHD or be on the autism spectrum or have a learning difficulty like dyslexia or dysgraphia, that they don't have the tools. So it's not their fault, but they're caught in the middle. They're caught in between the parents and their kids who need the help, and this system that's not teaching them how to help properly. And as teachers, we all want to help. So how frustrating to know that you need to help, but you don't know how to do it.
Yeah. I mean, that's why you become a primary school teacher. You
that's want right. to
love and transform and inspire these young people. And then when the reality hits you that they learn differently, it's quite a challenge. I'd really love to ask you about, for Australian parents out there, what kind of practical online Facebook groups and, you know, resources out there that you would recommend for parents at different stages of this process? Like, they're just discovering, or they're at your stage? What kind of resources are you using? What kind of resources are you using as a parent of a 12-year-old?
For sure. So one of the first things that I would do would be to join some local Facebook groups to your area. So there's a couple of really big ones in Australia. So we've got Dyslexia Support Australia and Dyslexia Awareness Australia. They're a wealth of information. So we've got some parent advocates there that are all volunteers that are running these groups. And questions are asked. There's no question that's, you know, silly, or there's no question that's too small or too big. It's a really, really active couple of groups. And then there's also a group for each state that's specific to that state. So if you need to find, you know, an MSL or an OG teacher in your area, you can pose that question, and then, you know, people will recommend local teachers for you. There's also Spelled New South Wales, and there's one in each state. So there's Spelled South Australia. And they, on their websites, have some really great free resources too. So things like, I know on the South Australian one, there's hundreds of decodable readers that can be printed for free or downloaded straight to your tablet and read as a PDF. So there's some really great resources there. In terms of the tools and the gadgets that I use, I start quite early with the kids. So from year 4, if it's looking like we're going to need help ongoing, then I start introducing assistive technology to the kids. So I start with their iPads. And I do really simple things that the team from Apple actually taught me a few years ago. And I do this now with all our kids and parents. So as simple as going into the settings on your iPad or your iPhone or your iPod and turning on the accessibility features. So going into settings, going to accessibility, turning on the keyboard, your ability to do dictation. So that down the bottom beside your space bar, when you change keyboard, you pull up a little microphone and you can dictate, and it works in anything. It works in your email. It works in notes, it works in any word processing that you're doing on there. And as well as turning on your dictation, is turning on all of the text-to-speech options. So choosing the right voice. There's a couple of voices in there, particularly I like Alex, that's really quite predictive. So as it's reading to you, if it sees PRESENT, and you don't know if it's present or present, depending on the context of the sentence, he'll actually read you the right word because he's read ahead. So there's a couple of voices that are better than others. And just turning on that feature where you can use 2 fingers and swipe down from the top margin and any content on your screen will be read to you. Using Reader View when you're in Safari rather than just a normal view on a website, it simplifies any web page for you, takes out all of the junk, takes out the ads, takes out the pictures, and just leaves you with plain text. And then it reads it to you. So things like that most of us don't know are there that are already inbuilt for free. And I'm all about trying to find low cost or cheap tools for these families if I can, because they're spending money every week on specialist teaching. A lot of them are in private schools because they think they're going to get better learning support. So wherever we can, you know, use something that's built in or low cost is great. So things like apps like Spellbetter, where it's simply a microphone pops up on your screen, you tap it, you say a word, you tap it again, and the spelling of that word will pop up for you. You can say a sentence and the whole sentence will pop up for you to copy down and it will be spelled correctly. Things like Dragon Dictation software. So there's a free version that you can have as an app on your iPad or your phone. When you're heading into high school, something like Dragon Professional, where you've got, you know, your little headset and microphone. I've got lots of kids who are full-time using that in classrooms and dictating rather than handwriting everything. I use OneNote across all platforms, and I think that that's a really good introduction to Immersive Reader, as well as dictation, as well as being able to do things like, for example, my son can take his phone into class, take a photo of what's up on the whiteboard or the screen, send it directly to his OneNote, and then a picture of all those notes is in his OneNote, and I teach them that it's like a digital-based folder. Like when we went to school, we would have had a folder with all the tabs in it, one for each subject. So this is a digital folder for them. And we set it up with a tab or a folder for each subject. Within each subject, they have each topic or each day of the week or each date or however they lay it out. Take a photo, flick it straight in. You've got to do some dictation, do it straight into your OneNote. You've got to leave yourself a memo for what have I got for homework this afternoon, do it as a voice recording and put it straight in. So from about year four, so that about, you know, 9 and 10 years of age, we're teaching these things so that when they get to high school and they're bringing their own device every day, they pick it up and run with it. No one needs to help them and they're independent and they've got that sense of, you know, I can do this.
Wow, that's great. Those are some really powerful skills. There's some adults who don't have those skills.
No, that's right. And I often get parents saying, you know, can you teach us too? Or can we sit in because we need to know how to do this? And I've actually been, you know, some of the dictation things I've been using myself in recent months to do for some study that I've been doing. And I was sitting there typing out all these notes and summaries and reflections and thinking, why aren't you practicing what you're preaching? So I got out my phone and I dictated what I wanted to say into OneNote on my phone and watched it appear on my computer screen in front of me. And, you know, where have you been all my life? I don't know why I hadn't been doing it when I'd been teaching kids to do it for so long. So, you know, like I said before, they're not cheats. It's the smart way to do things. And so, yeah, you know, these are smart kids and smart families that we're dealing with. Use the smart option. And so now I'm doing it too.
Well, I find that when I teach my students how to mind map, I ask the parents to actually do it with their child so that they learn this common visual language and this organizational language together. And a lot of the parents are like, oh my goodness, this is just transforming my work or a presentation or a report and things like that. So and the thing is, it's inherited, isn't it?
It is.
So you can know, often one of you is gonna have it.
Yeah.
So the one of you as parents are going to benefit from it.
That's right. But you know what? It's not just the technology and the mind mapping that I'm having parents come in and say, you know, why didn't anyone ever teach us this? It's basic phonics. So I send home activities for the kids to keep on going with during the week, you know, that they're not seeing me. And parents will say, you know, that rule that you taught us about when you use the long spelling of TCH instead of just CH, or when you use... When do you double the L, the F, the S and the Z? Why has no one ever taught me this rule? Or why has no one ever explained that you use AI in the middle of a word and AY at the end of a word? So our parents don't know it. Our kids don't know it. Our teachers don't know it. Lots of the parents that I have are teachers themselves, and they're not teaching it in classrooms because it was never taught to them when they were in classrooms or when they were studying at uni. So
you've got primary school teachers who are bringing their dyslexic children to you to teach them how to read, and then they're going into school to teach primary school themselves.
That's right. At least half a dozen of them.
Wow. Very similar to your story.
That's right. And why is it not, I don't understand why it's not out there. It's there's rules to phonics, there's a structure to our language. Teach the structure. If we taught the structure, it would alleviate so much of this need for external help and all this anxiety that these kids and these families are having. Just teach the structure.
Well, we're kind of going off piste here a little bit because I've finished my questions, but there's this whole thing about parents and how we as parents feel. You know, sometimes it can, there's lots of different emotions go through you as a parent when you're having to advocate for your child. And maybe you could run through a few, you've touched on them, but maybe you could summarize them, because sometimes parents can feel like, or be made to feel, or not be made to feel, but end up feeling that they're in the wrong, or that they're stupid, or that they're overprotective, or have too high expectations of their children, or maybe even think their child is smarter than they really are. There's all sorts of things that people feel in this process. Would you give some insight into that, maybe from your own personal point of view as well?
Yeah, look, I think I end up seeing, you know, mainly two categories of parents. So I see the parent that I've become, which is the fighter and the stepping on toes mum, who, you know, I don't care if school tells me that I can't take my kid out for private lessons, we're going to do it anyway, or school's using a non-evidence-based program with my child, they're not comfortable with it, they're feeling anxious, so I don't want them removed for that program anymore. So I see the parent who will fight for their child even if they tread on toes at school. And then I see the parent, and this is probably more common, who thinks that whatever school says must be right or must be truth. So if school says, you know, we're doing things the right way, or he'll be fine, there's nothing wrong with him, or just give it time, or he's not ready yet, he'll get there, they're the ones I worry about. Because if we give it time and we just wait and we settle for this low level of literacy, then these kids, no one's going to pick them up. So it's about...
In Scotland, we call it wait to fail.
Yes, here too. Here too. And I am a firm believer in, you know, eight is too late. So we've got to catch these kids when they're six and when they're seven. I don't think it's never going to happen once they're eight, but it just makes it so much harder. So,
well, that's quite a phrase. Eight is too late.
Catch them early.
So there's two folk, the ones who've turned into fighters and those who have said, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, you must
that's
be right.
And I think eventually those ones who are, you know, yes, you must be right, they have to make a choice if they're going to turn into a fighter. And all those fighters, the parents who fight, there's always a story. There's a reason why they're now so fierce. So finding out those stories is really interesting. So, you know, I'm fierce when it comes to my kids and their education now because of, I guess, the treatment and the lack of interest that we had from school when they were little. You know, I'll never forget going into a meeting with the principal of the primary school and said, you know, don't worry, he'll get by on his smile. That he'll get by on his smile, I will hear forever. And something like that makes you fight. Something like getting a little note from your child when he's eight that says, I'm a loser and I can't even read a book, left on your pillow when you go to bed at night with everything spelt wrong. That makes you fight. So, you know, that group of mums out there, and there's lots of them who are passionate advocates either on a big scale or just for your own child, it doesn't matter, but advocate. Don't sit back and wait to fail.
Could you give some insights on the cost of being the parent of a dyslexic?
Because emotionally,
there are multiple costs of being a parent of a dyslexic. I mean, I've heard from you the emotional side of things, but I've also, you've taken your child out of school, you know, into a private school, you've got tutors, you've driven miles, you spent lots of your extracurricular time, by the sounds of it, studying and learning about this and so on. it's one of these things that people don't tell you, you know, oh, your child's dyslexic. And then I think schools have realized there's a cost that comes with a child mm-hmm. who's dyslexic, a cost in time and effort and resources.
That's right. What, so look, the cost is
really... What's your take on that, your experience?
The cost is really high. So emotionally, when every day is a fight, and when you see your child so disheartened every day and they come home from school, I didn't get it, it was hard again, I'm never going to catch up, that's heartbreaking as a parent. And then to sit and worry when they're 17, 18, 19, you know, what are they going to be? What are they going to do? Now, I am fortunate that I don't worry about that now because I can see the other side. But I sit across from mums every day who are still in that, what are they going to be? You know, so emotionally, that's really hard. Financially, some families financially just can't do what I've been lucky enough to be able to do for my child. So if you go and get a formal assessment over here, it's about $1,000 Australian to get an assessment, to get a diagnosis. You get that diagnosis of, it won't say dyslexia anymore, it will say specific learning disability in reading or specific learning disability in writing. Take it to school. Often school will just file it and not do anything with it. And that's not necessarily the fault of the school, that's the fault of the system. There's no funding in Australia for a child with a diagnosis of a learning difficulty. So you go and you spend your $1,000, you get your report, your assessment, your label, and then nothing happens as a result of it, apart from you know that there's a reason. So you seek outside help for your child because school is not using an evidence-based program. And you can be looking at $100, $150 for a one-hour session a week. And often, you know, kids need 2 or 3 sessions a week. It's out of reach of most people. Wow. If you do what we've done and move from a public school to a private school over here, you can be looking at anything from $7,000 to $15,000 Australian a year for a private school. And I am fortunate that I live in an area where we can afford to do that. And the kids that come and see me, parents make whatever sacrifice they need to make to come and get that specialist help for their child. But what about, you know, half an hour from here or families that have single parents or they're not in a position to take their child out of school to come and get private lessons because A, they can't afford it, or B, both parents need to work so that they can afford the school that they're in. So if these things were provided in school, by school, as part of everyday language instruction, well, that financial cost goes away.
Is that going to happen anytime soon?
I would love to say yes, but I don't think that that's realistic. Things like the phonics check that you guys have in the UK, we've been fighting for years to get that brought in over here. We've had one state trial it in the last 12 months really successfully, but there's no move at the moment to bring it in other states. So if we had that screener, we'd be screening our six-year-olds. We'd know who was at risk. And then it becomes not just a matter of screening them. It's okay, we've identified these kids. What do we do with them now? Over here, there's no current evidence-based program that's mandated to be used across the board. So we did have a program called Reading Recovery, which was whole language based on sight words. Look at the picture and guess, look at the first sound and guess. That's no longer going to be funded, but schools are not prohibited from using it or self-funding it. There's no replacement for that. That is evidence-based, systematic, structured phonics.
So it's down to the parents to do something about it then?
That's right. That's right. So collectively, you know, there's a big group making a lot of noise over here, but noise is just noise unless someone's listening to it.
Well, that's very insightful, Lee. Thank you very much. I'm sure the parents who are listening to it, I think this will be a favorite podcast of so much information just downloaded in such a short space of time. This hour has been packed full of insights. So thank you so much for this. Before we go, how do people connect with you if they're maybe local or interested, or how do they connect with you, Lee?
So you can find me on Facebook at either Tactile Teaching or Hills Literacy and Learning. And I'm based in Castle Hills. Hills, H-I-L-L-S, literacy and learning, or at Tactile Teaching.
Okay, tactileteaching.com or?
Just if you search Tactile Teaching on Facebook or Hills Literacy and Learning on Facebook.
Okay.
Okay.
Facebook's the way to go.
Facebook's the way to find me.
Okay. Any final things you'd like to say? I've asked all the questions. Are there anything you'd like to say to wrap things up?
I guess a message to parents or mums out there who are fighting the same issues that I've fought over the years is to keep going. Don't settle and say, okay, he will just get by on his smile, or we'll just use these non-evidence-based programs at schools. Don't settle. Ask questions, go to meetings, take questions with you, and stand your ground, because your kids are worth fighting for, and there's nothing more important than their education. So if you're hitting a brick wall, change direction and keep changing it until you find your way through.
Thank you, Lee. Well, maybe we'll get you on another time in the future, maybe in a year's time, and you can give us an update or something. So thanks very much, Lee. I'll see you later.
That's all right. All right. Thanks, Darius. Bye.